This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening, everyone. Why don't we get started? My name is Bobby Barron. I'm Associate Dean for Graduate and Continuing Education here at UCSF. I'm also a professor of medicine, and I'm the director of the UCSF OSHA Mini Medical School, and I'm really pleased that you've been coming to so many of our courses, and particularly this one. I'll also serve as your course chair for this particular course. I went to nutrition school before I went to medical school, and I've always had an interest in the interface between nutrition and medicine in general, and more specifically nutrition and prevention and chronic disease. I'm a general internist by training myself, and so it's really a great opportunity, I think, for me to reach out to you all and tell you what I've been thinking about in terms of nutrition and how you can use it in your life. We'll meet here each Wednesday night. We'll start at 7. We'll go to 8:30 or 9, depending on comments and questions. And we have what I hope will be a terrific lineup of speakers. I'll speak again next week and talk about obesity and weight management, focusing on some of the controversial areas in obesity. And then there'll be two lectures by Katie Ferraro, who's a nurse and dietitian, certified nurse educator, a dietetic educator. She works in our nursing school and has done a very successful online course on nutrition that UCSF put on through the Coursera mechanism that some of you may be familiar with. And she'll be here live with us for the third and fourth weeks of the course, talking about dietary fats and later dietary fiber. Our fifth week will be Dr. Robert Lustig, who many of you know is a professor of endocrinology at UCSF and has received a lot of very positive attention for a recent book he released called Fat Chance, and of course a YouTube video which was made in this room at one of these courses several years ago about the role of sugar in our diets, and he'll be back to tell you what he's learned in the years since then about that subject. And then we'll end the last night of in June with one of my colleagues, Jeffrey Tice, who will talk about vitamins and mineral supplements with a lot of emphasis on particularly vitamin D, but also many of the other nutrients of controversy that you all may be thinking about. My goal tonight, and I think throughout the course, is we'll go through the material. I'll stop periodically. I'm happy to take questions as we go along, but also we'll see how the flow goes, and we might take a few and then go on again and take some more and then use the bulk of the time at the end for discussion. My goal tonight is to talk about what makes a healthy diet. I know in the Bay Area in 2013 you can't pick up the paper or turn on the TV or radio without hearing something new about nutrition. So the slight obscurity that I encountered studying nutrition 35 years ago, 40 years ago, really is not true anymore. I think we all think about it. We live in a culture that's very food-centric. And I know that most of you are love food and know a lot about nutrition. And so it's with some humility that I'll tell you some of the things that I've learned in the last couple of years that I think are relevant. My favorite role is to be the tiebreaker. You've probably heard two different things, and you're not sure which is correct. And I'll weigh in and tell you what my thoughts are based on the best scientific evidence that I'm aware of. Let's begin. Very good. I do want to acknowledge both Katie, who I mentioned, who will be our lecturer in the third and fourth week, and also another colleague, Beth Gonzalez, whose slides I used in part for some of the graphics that you'll see later in the talk. Why do we care what we eat? Well, this is relatively well established. If you look at the causes of death in the United States, and this is increasingly true worldwide as well, you see that the bulk of death is still caused by heart disease and cancer. Stroke is number 4, diabetes is number 7. And these 4 causes of death, which make up the bulk of premature mortality in the United States, especially in adults, has a tremendous relationship to diet. Now, cigarettes are as, if not substantially, more important than diet. Now, I'm not going to talk about tobacco control, although I will make some analogies to tobacco control, because I think one of the take-home messages may be that some of the successes we've had with tobacco may be relevant to the way we approach nutrition from a policy point of view. Tobacco causes even more preventable deaths than nutrition, but these 4 causes of death are thought to be related to what we eat. And we can account for about a third of premature deaths in the United States related to nutrition and physical activity. We tend to put those together. We'll talk about physical activity both a tiny bit tonight, but a little bit more next week. 50% of American adults do not get the recommended amounts of physical activity. And only 10% of Americans eat a diet consistent with nutrition recommendations. And I'll review what those are and which parts are controversial and which parts have a consensus around them. And in short, and I'll probably say this 3 or 4 times, as you know, we think that our diet is too high in saturated and trans fatty acids, too high in salt, and particularly too high in refined sugars and other refined carbohydrates, and too low in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, calcium, and fiber. And so we'll spend the next 6 weeks dissecting those simple principles there in greater depth. Now, again, these diseases are not caused exclusively by diet and lifestyle, but again, we can account for a substantial proportion of it, but clearly genetic factors play a tremendous role. But as we learn more and more about genetics, we realize that genetics aren't a static process, that our genes also react to our environment in multiple ways. And so not only are you born with certain predispositions, but environment can up or down regulate various genes as well in ways that we're just beginning to understand. So we don't really know how big that purple area is, but we know there is a purple area. And moreover, when we think about the whole of that picture, that we know that at least some of it is nature, if you will, and some of it is nurture. With obesity, for example, we think that about half of obesity is related to genetics. And the good news about that is usually when we see a patient in the office who's struggling with their weight, we can say to them, a lot of this is genetics-based, and therefore it's not your fault that you are suffering from obesity. On the other hand, it's not hopeless, because the other half or so is related to your diet and lifestyle. And so that's an approach that's true for, most clearly established for weight, but we think by analogy true for many of the other nutrition-related, activity-related illnesses. So where are we at in the 21st century? Well, over the last 30 years, we've gotten bigger, and I'll show you specific data on this next week. But if we look at calories, we've increased our calorie intake by about 500-600 calories over the course of the last 30 years. I'll show you next week that the prevalence of obesity in the United States appears to have flattened out. And so this data that goes up to 2008, we don't know for sure what the data is for the last 5 years, but weights appear to have stabilized a bit, at least on average, and that's really more for next week. But clearly there's been this marked increase, and from certainly an evolutionary point of view, this has been extraordinarily dramatic when you think about how many millennia it took for us to evolve. So our environment is clearly built with a surplus of calories, and we're consuming them. Now, here are the top calorie sources in the United States. This is what we eat. Now, these foods may not look exactly like your menu choices or even the way you think about foods when you shop. These are meant to be from questionnaires. This is data from what's called the N. Haynes Survey, which is a carefully done survey of health habits in the United States, the Nutrition and Health Survey. But number one is our desserts, mostly cookies and cakes and so forth. Number two is breads. And keep this in mind, we'll come back to both of these. Chicken is third. Soda, energy drinks, and sport drinks, and pizza. Fifth is alcoholic beverages. I'm not going to say that much about alcohol tonight, except to say that alcohol has the same amount of calories as carbohydrate. Has more calories than carbohydrate per gram, and a glass of alcohol has roughly the same amount of calories as a Pepsi. And so although we think that alcohol has certain health benefits for those who use it, it also comes with a calorie cost, and that's a point we'll come back to. We'll also say more about pasta and pasta dishes. You see a trend here between the excess carbohydrates here, 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 and then some of the other dishes, again, with another form of desserts on the bottom. Now, keep this list a little bit in mind because I'm going to show you another list of foods later in the talk when we talk about a different nutrient, and you'll see that it's quite similar. Another nutrient we're concerned about, and it's a quite a similar list. And one of the observations that's been made recently, this is from an article that was just published this year, is that a big part of the excess calories we consume comes from restaurant foods, and this is well known to you. And as you know, with busy schedules and dual parent parents working outside the home, and the greater availability of restaurants and the, if you will, status that sometimes restaurant eating brings to family life and the like, and the pleasure, we eat in restaurants much more than we used to. And strikingly, if you look at the calories per meal, calories that we obtain, that we eat in a restaurant are, on average, substantially higher than what we eat at home. And that's true for individuals who are normal weight, as well as individuals who are overweight or obese. And this is just some examples. This came from a recent article in the Center for Science and the Public Interest, one of the websites I'll recommend at the end. And you can see that some of the dishes commonly sold in particularly fast food restaurants or in between fast food and less fast food restaurants. So Pizzeria Uno's Chicago classic deep dish pizza is 2,300 calories. I should say at the outset that the average person, most people in the room need about 2,000 calories to break even. That is to maintain your current body weight. If you want to lose weight, you need to eat less than that. If you eat more than that, you'll gain weight, depending on how much you exercise. Yes?
Is that 2,300 calories
for the whole pot? Yes. Well, I'm not, yes, it would be for the, it's a personal though. You know, it's a one person dish. Right, that one happens to be a deep dish. I'm not sure, we'll come back to that. So this Chipotle's Mexican grill burritos, 1,200 calories. McDonald's chicken breast strips, 1,000 calories, and the like. So if you're scheduled to eat 2,000 calories a day, you can see that some of these meals take a big chunk out of your budget. And again, the take-home point is not to say that these are never things to eat, but one should be aware that if one's budget is 2,000 calories a day, and if you eat 800 for lunch, that leaves 1,200 for the rest of the day. So it's not a matter of black and white or cut and dry, but rather a matter of understanding what the budget should be, what your energy requirements are. So let's drill down a little bit more into some of the basic principles of nutrition and how it connects with some of these issues. So when we talk about nutritional science, we talk about two classes of nutrients, so-called macronutrients and micronutrients. And these roughly, by convention, represent different quantities as needed by the human body. So for example, so in this case, macronutrients are nutrients that are needed in large amount by the body, and it's usually measured in grams. Macronutrients provide energy. So all of our energy in the human diet comes from these four macronutrients. And therefore, you can calculate the amount of energy, if you burned it in a calorimeter, that each gram of each of these four substances, how much heat it would generate, and that's what we call calories. In common, these are actually kilocalories, abbreviated as kcals. We use calories as common speech, and in scientific language, it can also be abbreviated calories, but with a capital C. So this is a little confusing, but it's fine to use the word calories, but keeping in mind that scientifically what we really mean is kilocalories. And on food labels, you'll see it often written this way. These are all synonyms. The word calories, kilocalories, kcals, and calories with a capital C. One does not need alcohol, but it provides energy. So I'm not suggesting these are needs. I'm just suggesting that these are the amount of calories that are generated by these foods. So I'm not suggesting you need alcohol, but if you consume alcohol and your budget is 2,000 calories, the alcohol becomes part of that budget. Well, we'll come back to the, we'll talk about quantities later on. The numeric quantity is a gram, but we'll convert that, so it's a gram in the metric system, but we'll convert that to portion sizes a little bit later in the talk. So carbohydrates generate 4 calories per gram, protein 4 calories per gram. Fat is more dense, and it generates 9 calories per gram. And alcohol is intermediate at 7 calories per gram. These are important to keep in mind when you're looking at food labels. So here's an example of a food label. Now, I've blotted out the number here. Normally on the food label, you would be able to see this number. And the most important thing when you look at a food label, in addition to seeing the calories, is what the portion size is. So we'll talk about serving sizes the way that nutritionists use the term serving size, but a serving size as used by the food companies, the food industry, is not necessarily the same as a serving size as defined by nutritionists. And we'll come back to that point later on. But the way you can most easily get fooled by a food label is by looking at this and seeing it looks good and then figuring out that the serving size is tiny. And then, in fact, you were about to just eat 3 of them. And we'll show some examples of that. But that's not the point of this particular slide. The point of this particular slide is if I were to ask you how many calories are in a serving of this particular product, the way you would figure that out would be to identify how many grams of carbohydrate, how many grams of protein, how many grams of fat, and multiply them by these respective numbers. And so usually you don't have to do that arithmetic yourself, but it's important to understand that all of our calories in food, with the exception of alcohol, comes from one of these 3 macronutrients. And we'll talk a little bit tonight and even more next week about how there are some debates about how much we should eat of one macronutrient or the other. But it's worth understanding the different calorie implications of them. So there are 4 grams of fat, so we would multiply that by 9. Actually, I think I did this here. We would multiply that by 9. There are 8 grams of carbohydrate, so we would multiply that by 4. And there are 31 grams of protein down here, and we would multiply that by 4, and we'd get the numbers and add them up, and so a serving of this food has 192 calories. And so this is all arithmetic. It all makes sense. And the key point here is that there are only 3 macronutrients plus alcohol, and they generate all of the energy in our food. Yes?
Are all fat calories abuse density?
Yes. So saturated fats, trans fats, monounsaturated fats, all have 9 calories per gram. And the same is true with carbohydrates and protein. So vegetable protein and meat protein have the same. Simple sugars and complex carbohydrates have the same, and so on. Yes?
Cholesterol being a lipid, is that factored in?
Yes. So that would be part of the amounts of total fat. But cholesterol is usually in the food in milligrams and doesn't contribute by weight the same amount as some other fats. It's sort of intermediate. But yes, dietary cholesterol. Cholesterol is a little confusing, and we'll talk about this in much more detail in Katie's session. But dietary cholesterol, the cholesterol in food, is a different terminology than the cholesterol in our blood that we measure and say you have a high blood cholesterol. So it's a little bit confusing. The same chemical, but useful in both settings. But yes, cholesterol would be included as part of the fat weight and calories. Now, the recommendation for macronutrient intake turns out now to be quite diverse. So these are the recommendations from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and also the Institute of Medicine, who makes most of our nutrition recommendations in the United States, the recommended dietary allowances and some of the newer definitions of that. But this is a very interesting evolution because some of you may remember some of the earlier recommendations back in the 80s, where it was very specific. We were really focusing on a low-fat intake as the primary strategy of improving our heart health and diet related to heart health. And so we somewhat dogmatically said fat should be less than 30% of calories. And as you do the arithmetic, remember here, another key point is that there are only 3 of these, plus alcohol. So if you lower one, it means you have to raise the other. Often protein is a constant, and so many of the debates amongst nutritionists are the relative merits between carbohydrate and fat. So if someone says they're on a low-carbohydrate diet, and in fact they are on a low-carbohydrate diet, then that means they're getting more of their calories from either fat or protein or both. Right? There aren't that many. There are no other options. It's only 3 things. But what's really interesting about these recommendations is that these percents are a very wide range, which is really different than it was 20, 30 years ago. So this is quite interesting. What we're saying is that the nutritional science is such that we no longer need to be dogmatic about precise amounts of one macronutrient or another. And this is a theme that you'll hear about all through the course, but for many purposes, I would argue that the total amount of calories trumps the exact macronutrient composition of the foods. In other words, if you're eating the right amount of calories to maintain your body weight, you have a fair amount of flexibility as to whether you're on a lower carbohydrate intake or a higher carbohydrate intake. And that's a theme I'll come back to. And same with fat. And you can see there's a fairly wide range. Oh, the other point about this is look how high the range is for protein. So we used to think about protein as being sort of a fixed amount. It used to be about 15% of the diet. But again, we've realized that excess protein per se, people used to say, well, it'd be bad for your kidneys. You couldn't metabolize all this extra nitrogen and so on. That turns out not to be true for people with normal kidneys. And so although people on a kidney failure have to restrict their protein, it's not true for the average person. So this is quite a wide range. Now, micronutrients are vitamins and minerals, and they're called micronutrients because we need them in smaller amounts, and this is either in the quantity of milligrams or micrograms. So these are nutrients we don't synthesize them, so they're essential nutrients. We need them supplied from external to the diet, from the food supply, because we don't synthesize them ourselves. So those are essential nutrients or essential micronutrients. And again, they don't, these, as in contrast to the macronutrients, do not generate energy, but they serve very specific biochemical and other functions that we need from the diet, and those are vitamins and minerals. And generally, we do okay with these in the United States, in part because of food supplementation, food enrichment, and fortification that I'll come to in a moment. But in terms of inadequate intakes, the nutrients that are on the shorter list of things that come up are dietary potassium, dietary fiber, which we'll have an entire lecture on. We've entitled that one the most important nutrient with a question mark, because I think marks a healthy diet. Dietary calcium, and vitamin D. And you'll hear about all of these throughout the course. Now, this is a long list, a complicated slide that is another way of looking at both some of the micronutrients, but also some of the components of macronutrients. And this is a list of food elements, foods and nutrients, that the FDA has approved for the food industry to put on a label with a legitimate claim. Now, that's not to say that these are all scientifically proven to a high enough level of confidence that consistent with what we would expect the way we practice medicine. So these are mostly linkages from large population-based studies. And they're almost never what we experimental, that is randomized experiments, where we give some people one and some people the other and see what happens. And that's a level of science that we demand with medications and increasingly are beginning to demand with nutrition as well, but there aren't that many of those kind of studies. And I'll refer to several of them as we go through both tonight and next week, but that's really the standard as we go forward for how we know what we know. But these are relationships that have been, or associations that have been developed from large epidemiologic or population-based, or what we call observational studies, where we just follow a population and see what kind of risks and outcomes develop. Calcium and also vitamin D, very important for bone health. Sodium is associated with high blood pressure, and we know that if you lower your sodium and you have high blood pressure, about one out of three people will lower their blood pressure, but not everyone. Saturated fat and cholesterol are related to coronary heart disease. That's the one we've heard the most about. Fat in general, total fat, is associated with some cancers. Breast cancer, the data is a little bit wobbly, but this has been an association that's been made with breast cancer and others. Fiber, again, we'll talk about, or fruits and vegetables as a food, also associated with cancers or lowering cancer risk if you eat more of them. Again, soluble fiber is associated with heart disease. A high intake of soluble fiber like psyllium and flax and things like that can lower your blood cholesterol. Fruits and vegetables reduces cancer. Folic acid, now supplemented to our grains and in prenatal birth control pills, is associated with birth defects, particularly one called the neural tube defect. This has been virtually gone away in the United States because of supplementation of foods with folic acid. Sugars and tooth decay, soluble fiber again from these foods associated with heart disease, soy, heart disease, whole grains, heart disease, and certain cancers. Plant sterols and stanols are chemicals that also lower your blood cholesterol and can be used therapeutically, and we'll come back to that, lowering your heart disease risk. And potassium is associated, high potassium intake, as found in fruits and vegetables, is associated with reductions in blood pressure and thereby stroke. So this is a long list, but it again, all things you've almost certainly encountered because they're on food labels. And if it's on a food label, in most cases, not necessarily in smaller retail settings, and there are some differences with certain with food supplements, different sets of rules. But with big commercial foods, these are the labels that have been vetted, and you'll see on foodstuffs. And keep in mind, they all might be true. These are all hypotheses and more than proven, but they are associated with these relationships. Yes?
What are the down arrows? It would seem that...
That means a reduction in risk.
No, but I mean, it seems like sugar alcohols lowers tooth decay risk, and that's not true, right?
No, it increases tooth decay risk. That's... I think it's more if you reduce sugar alcohols, you have less tooth decay risk. If you increase folic acid, you decrease neural tube defects. I agree. The arrows are a little confusing in the way I put this together. Yeah, it's probably it would be a better slide without the arrows. It's an association of the food and the disease. Now, another concept I want to mention is nutrient density. This is the relationship between the amount of nutrients in a food and the calories. So it's a ratio or a relationship between a given nutrient per calorie is a way to think of it. And so when we eat natural whole foods, the amount of vitamins and minerals and fiber and so on per gram of energy or gram of food or calorie is more dense. So in this example, grapes compared to soda pop. So there are more nutrients and fewer calories equals of being nutrient dense. And typically, one achieves nutrient dense foods by selecting foods from each food group, a concept we'll come to in a moment, without added fats and added sugars. So nothing added here, added sugar here. So this is an example of that. It's a little extreme, but makes the point. Comparing ice cream to low-fat milk, you can see that low-fat milk has 100 calories per serving in this example. Ice cream is close to 300. There's more calcium, even though there are less calories. So you would say milk is more nutrient dense as regards to calcium than is ice cream. And similarly, much more vitamin D and a little bit more potassium. So one of the goals in selecting foods is to select nutrient dense foods. The inverse is what people have called empty calories. So that's an example of foods that have a very low nutrient density. That is to say, there's a lot of calories, but not much else. So added sugars, added fats, and so forth would be examples of foods with low nutrient density. And here are some other examples. so just some arbitrary comparisons. But this is chicken nuggets, which are 230 calories and 12 grams of protein. And a skinless chicken breast is lower calories and more protein. So there's greater nutrient density as regards to protein. Here again, French fries compared to a baked potato, twice as many calories, 9 milligrams of vitamin C, half as many calories, twice as much vitamin C. So a baked potato has a greater nutrient density for vitamin C. And here's apple pie and an apple making the same point. So even though this has a higher absolute amount, the amount per calorie is still lower than we get from the apple because the calories are so high in this example. So this is a useful concept. And when you're thinking about foods, another way to think about it is not only what is the calorie intake and what is the nutrient intake, but what is the relationship of those two in terms of deciding whether this is a, quote, healthy food or a good food choice. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on phytochemicals, but again, just to run through some basic nutritional concepts. This is another one that you'll hear about or have heard about. These are substances found in plant foods. The body does not need them as far as we know. So as far as nutritional science has developed, they're not required for maintenance of growth and reproduction, and there's no deficiency syndrome if they're not in the diet. But they may have other health-promoting properties that we're still learning about. And some examples of things you've heard about that fall into this category are carotenoids. Vitamin A comes from carotenoids. Beta-carotene is a vitamin A precursor, but there are actually another 70 or so carotenoids in a carrot, for example. And we don't think of them as being essential nutrients, but they might turn out to be really important. They have anti-inflammatory effects in laboratory settings and the like. Flavonoids, phytoestrogens are other examples of this. So one of the rationales when you think about making food choices, one of the reasons we like to eat plants is because not only do they have essential nutrients that we've identified, but they have other nutrients that we think might be healthy that we don't fully understand their biochemical or nutritional role. So this is a conditional term. They may have health-promoting properties, but you don't get them if you are just adding back vitamins and minerals to food. You don't add back. If you add back vitamin A or if you take a pill of beta-carotene, that's one thing, but you're not getting the other 69 carotenoids that you would get if you ate a carrot. Question?
What keeps us from better understanding
Well, you can. We understand them pretty well in laboratory settings, but the question is their impact on human health requires, you know, more complex kind of science like experiments with humans. And we'll talk later in the month, about some examples with the carotenoids, for example. So in the test tube, carotenoids are anti-inflammatory. If we look at populations of people who eat more carotenoids are healthier, have less heart disease and less cancer, than people who eat less carotenoids. So people who eat more do better than people who are associated with better outcomes than people who eat less. If we measure blood levels of carotenoids, people with higher blood levels do better than people with lower blood levels. But if we give people a pill of beta-carotene, people do worse than people who got a fake pill. So these are very hard. It's very hard to go from what's in the laboratory science to even what's in the blood and what's in the diet to what actually happens if you give supplements. Now, so the real studies become, well, why don't we give 100 people carrots and 100 people no carrots and see what happens. But then there are all these other confounders, and those become very hard experiments to do, although I'll show you some examples of that kind of study later in the talk. There's also another concept that's worth noting. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one either, but enriched foods and fortified foods are two definitions you'll encounter. Enriching foods or enrichment is adding back nutrients that are lost during processing. And this is most commonly done with grains. So remember that a grain has an outer covering, which is very healthy, and an inner covering, the fiber and the endosperm, where all the a lot of the vitamins and minerals are. And the middle part is the starchy part. The germ is the center part, and then the endosperm is the starchy part. And so what we do when we refine carbohydrates is we take away the outer part, we take away the germ, and we eat the middle part, the endosperm, and then we add back, at least in the developed world where we eat processed foods like this, we might add back some of the vitamins that have been taken out. The problem with that is we're missing some of the other nutrients, the other components in the grain that we may not have identified. So either our enrichment may be incomplete, or we're just missing stuff that could be healthy in the food that we don't know about. Fortification's a little bit different. It's adding nutrients back into a food that weren't there to begin with. So for example, until a decade or so ago, the idea that you could get calcium from orange juice was unheard of. But someone had the smart idea of supplementing orange juice, which we were drinking, with a nutrient we needed. And this became a relatively good source of calcium, especially for people who couldn't drink dairy products or milk. Iodine fortified salt is something we don't even think about, but the reason we don't have iodine deficiency in the United States and much of the developed world now is because of iodine fortification, and milk is fortified with vitamin D. Vitamin D is not naturally occurring in milk. We just put it in to provide a nutrient that we need that we don't get enough of. Functional foods are similar, and you'll see some are the same. I put this, sort of makes it on both lists. But these take it maybe even a step further, supplementing other substances into foods which may have health benefits. So some of you may have bought margarine with plant sterols, and these are some of the margarines, because as I said, plant sterols lower your blood cholesterol. So if you're on an aggressive non-pharmacologic, non-medication program to lower your blood cholesterol, eating extra plant stanols and sterols is another strategy to lower your blood cholesterol. And there are some margarines made that you can purchase that have extra plant sterols in them. That's a functional food. And adding flaxseed, for example, a source of soluble fiber to breakfast cereals would be another example of this. So these are concepts you'll run across: enrichment fortification and functional foods.
Is there any advantage to refined sugar versus unrefined sugar versus refined sugar?
Hold that question, and we'll come back to it a little bit later in the talk when we talk about sugar. Yes. So I don't know if everyone heard the question. The question is are there health benefits, I guess? Do I give credence to this approach? Well, yes. This is, as I mentioned, iodine fortification of salt eliminated iodine deficiency goiter in the United States. Right? The addition of folic acid to grains has eliminated neural tube defects virtually in the United States. So that kind of fortification, the implication of adding calcium to orange juice, I'm not sure we know the end results of as cleanly, but it sort of, I think it was a pretty good idea. You'll see I get later in the talk, I'm not going to recommend drinking a lot of orange juice. So to me, it's not that important. But if you're calcium insufficient and you can't eat dairy products, then this is another tool in your toolbox. You can also take calcium supplements. But the whole issue of how much calcium to take is a separate conversation. But vitamin D is a nutrient for which is insufficient. It was on the short list of things that we are concerned about from a public health point of view. You can get it from sun, but our concern about sun damage has prevented most people from getting adequate sun exposure and vitamin D and making enough vitamin D. So therefore, you have to eat vitamin D. Again, you can take it from a pill. But if you're someone who can tolerate dairy products, you can get it from supplemented dairy products. So these are perfectly good. These are not so good. These are sort of incomplete attempts to make a food which has been overly processed into a healthy food. Yes? So the question is, does sunscreen have an effect on vitamin D? The answer is yes. It blocks your ability to make vitamin D. Okay, principles of a healthy diet. There are a lot of things I could put on this slide, but I wanted to really keep it simple. And this really comes from observations of all the, if you look at the cultures around the world, particularly less developed cultures, and look at the kind of, quote, I hate to use the word, primitive diets or natural diets that people who live in less developed environments eat. But they're doing fine. They have healthy diets, lifestyles, long life expectancies, and the like. They have certain things in common. They eat a wide variety of foods. So if you eat a diet that is just one root, and that root happens to be low in protein, then you're going to develop protein insufficiency. Or if you eat one grain and it's deficient in corn and it's deficient in niacin, and that's all you eat, or it's your dominant calorie source, you'll develop a niacin deficiency, pellagra. On the other hand, if you eat lots and lots of different foods, then they add to each other and fill in around the gaps. And so we've thought a lot about this related to protein, which turns out to be not so important, but many of the early conversations put together different complementary proteins that were a little lower in one amino acid, higher in another. But the point here is that if you eat a variety of foods, you typically cover all of the bases. Secondly, that only works if the food is of high quality. So if you eat a wide variety of lousy food, right, that's not a healthy diet. And we'll come back to that point. And then third, you have to eat the right quantity. So even if you eat a very healthy diet, if you eat more than your energy requirements, you will become obese. And that's at the center of some of the health consequences of nutrition and chronic disease. So these are three easy-to-remember elements of what constitute a healthy diet. So many of you are old enough to remember the four food groups. This was not the first attempt by the government to provide nutrition advice, but it definitely was the first major event that dominated school education, certainly in my era. Every time you went to see the school nurse or anywhere else or the doctor's office, there was always a picture of the four food groups. Milk was always in the upper left-hand corner, and because this was funded by the dairy industry, amongst others. But dairy, meat, fish, and fowl, grains, not a very good cartoon here, and fruits and vegetables. And this was an attempt to get at which of these three principles? Variety, right? But it didn't really tell us much about quality, and it didn't tell us much about quantity. But it got us started on variety. It said, eat X number amounts of the different food groups, and that will cover all your vitamin and mineral needs. But it didn't really talk to us about what kind of fat was in the dairy, was it saturated fat, unsaturated fat, what kind of carbohydrates were in the grains, and so on, and what kind of fats were in the meats. In 1992, many of you were, this is more a different era, many of you are the right age for this one, the food group pyramid, which came out in 1992, this had a fairly good run. It lasted for about a decade or so. And now you can see there's stronger opinions about how much. So now we're dealing with variety, and now we're weighing in about quantity as well. And this was in an era where we thought fat was the primary problem in our diet. And so the food pyramid, which was designed visually or graphically so that the most important foods were at the base, and the least important foods at the top. That was sort of the graphic design here. And that the bulk of our calories should come from bread, cereal, rice, and pasta, and then a lot from fruits and vegetables. And this was meant to be small, which is fats, oils, and sweets. And then, again, milk and dairy in the upper left, and meat, fish, and fowl. But again, now we're getting some recommendations related to variety and also to quantity. But it doesn't really tell you, it tells you relative quantity, but you have to be pretty precise on what a serving is to get this to add up to the right amount of total calories. In addition, there was quite a big range. I mean, 6 to 11, well, that's a factor of 2. So who eats 6 and who eats 11? So there was some confusion about that. This was based on body weight, gender, and so forth. But that message didn't always come across clearly. And this is, in fact, what we eat. So the pyramid didn't quite work because We ended up eating a lot more of our calories from the top of the pyramid, the so-called fats, oils, and sweets that we were supposed to use sparingly. In fact, we're eating quite a bit of. And as you know, we don't eat enough fruits and vegetables. There was another one that I've skipped called My Pyramid, which was a slight variation on the pyramid. That one didn't last very long and didn't have much impact on nutrition education, but was a hybrid, if you will, of the food group pyramid and the current one. But this is the current system. It was it's been around since about 2010, 2011, different components. And you can find this on choosemyplate.gov, which is one of the websites I've given you on at the end. And this is the visual. It's nice. It's a very clean visual. Simple, makes the point that we want, again, variety from, in this case, five food groups instead of the traditional four, breaking out fruits and vegetables into their own group. Calling this protein rather than meat, fish, or fowl, representing that vegetable protein is also an acceptable alternative, and dairy. And then on the website, they drill down into much more detail with examples of how to use MyPlate. So this is a very good resource, and I urge you to glance at this. I'll read some of this. But it is an attempt to give you some quantities and also to emphasize a little bit now for the first time a little bit more attention towards the quality of the food. So it doesn't get all the way there, but we're talking now about making half of your grains so-called whole grains or unrefined, a variety of vegetables, and it gives some quantities of the different colors of vegetables that you should include. Focus on fruits, eating a variety of fruits. Don't forget calcium-rich foods, and that if you're unable to eat dairy, that there's an alternative calcium plan. And then protein, the emphasis being on lean meat, fish, and fowl, or vegetarian alternatives. Know your limits on fats, sugars, and sodium. And this has to do with the nutrient density of the food and how much extra room you have in your budget for empty calories. So if you've eaten a lot of nutrient-dense foods, you may have a little bit more room to eat some fats and sugars or alcohol and not exceed your total calorie intake. But others may need the entire budget, if you will, in order to meet their micronutrient needs. And then we'll talk about physical activity, but the recommendations are strong on physical activity as well. So again, glance at this website. It's tremendously resource-rich as far as being able to plan diets and so on. And of course, there are many other alternatives. There are many applications you can use and the like. So just to drill down on a few of these, again, looking at the current key recommendations, and then we'll go beyond the current recommendations as to what some of the issues are and what some of the alternative approaches are. So enjoy your food, but eat less. Avoid oversized portions. So for that, you need to know what a portion is. They use the plate in part because one of the tools that dietitians use very commonly is recommending that people limit their meals, particularly the evening meal, to the amount of food on a small to a medium-sized plate. So that's another tool that you'll see, and that's partly why the visual of my plate was chosen. Make half your plate fruits and vegetables. If you do use milk, make sure it's low-fat or fat-free milk. Watch for sodium or salt in foods like soup, bread, and frozen meals. Choose the foods with lower numbers and drink water instead of sugary drinks. So pretty common sense. They make reference to obesity, the focus being reduce your overall calorie intake. Shifting intake patterns to more vegetables, cooked beans, peas, and fruits, whole grains, nuts, and seeds. Increase seafood and low-fat milk and dairy, and moderate amounts of lean meats, poultry, and eggs. I'm not sure I agree with the eggs. I realize I don't speak about that for the remainder of the talk, but for most people, if you're on a, if you have a cholesterol issue and you're trying to manage it with diet, and you stay on a relatively low-fat diet or a healthy fat diet, then adding more cholesterol to your diet doesn't change your blood cholesterol very much. Dietary cholesterol raises your blood cholesterol mostly in an environment that's high fat, high saturated fat. So that's a subtle point, but eggs, I think, in moderation are definitely part of a healthy diet. And then reducing solid fats and added sugars. Again, because these components have very low nutrient density. And we'll talk about sodium later. All right, so one of the big issues is refined grains. And the guidelines recommend 6 1-ounce servings per day for most of us on a 2,000-calorie-a-day diet. Those of you who are smaller and women in the room may need less than 2,000 calories a day. Younger people and men typically may need a bit more. But 2,000 is you're not going to be off by much unless you're at one of the extremes of age or size if you think about 2,000 calories. But again, the guide is 6 1-ounce servings. The average person eats 8 servings a day, and almost all of them are refined. What is a serving of grain? This is confusing, and that's why I want us to take an extra moment. Since you remember that list of foods that accounted for all the highest calories, that list of the 10 top foods. So carbohydrates or refined carbohydrates is one of the major sources of calories in the United States. And so it's a 1/2 cup of cooked rice, not uncooked rice as shown in the book, in the box, because that'll make about 4 servings, I guess. And so that's a difference between, this is a dietitian's serving, whereas the box might say 1 serving equals 1/2 cup of rice on the box, but that's irrelevant. That just helps you figure out what the label is, how to interpret the label. So it may not be a direct correlation between the serving size and the box and what we talk about when we talk about serving size in terms of nutrition. And that's an important principle. So it's 1/2 cup of the rice after it's cooked is when you measure it. 1/2 cup of cooked pasta. This is a big one. You know, people eat a plate of spaghetti, and it's four or five servings, and no one, and you don't even think about it. Or you go to a restaurant that's featuring rice, and you get a couple of scoops of rice, you've eaten 4 servings. And you can read some of the rest of these, but these are probably 2 of the most common. A slice of bread is a serving, and 1/2 a bun. Again, 1/2 a cup is equal to 1/2 a baseball. And I'll give you some other measures in a minute. Now, we spend a lot of time talking about whole grains, and you have to put this in quotes because one of the leading food markets uses this term as well. And not all the food necessarily in that particular food market meets these criteria, but much of it does. I like the store. That's not the point. The point is, what is a whole grain? And it turns out that bread, if you're really precise about this, bread is one of the toughest purchases to find as a whole grain. So if you're really committed to eating whole grains, what you really have to find is that the first ingredient on the label says whole. So whole wheat flour. And often it'll say cracked, it'll say refined, it'll say unbleached. The first word has to be whole. So the label of the bread doesn't matter. So whole wheat isn't necessarily a whole grain. It only if the label says it's a whole grain. And 9-grain bread doesn't mean they're all whole grains, just mixing flours and so on. And then we'll spend a lot more time on fiber intake later when Katie's going to emphasize this, so I don't want to spend too much time. But this is an important concept of finding whole grains from bread. Here are some other ways to, just as an aside, a little bit out of context, if you will, but some other examples, since we're talking about portion sizes, of ways you can use your hand in order to estimate sizes. So, and again, we're all built a little differently, so you have to take these with, again, a little bit of a grain of salt, no pun intended, if your hand is an extreme of large or small. But a fist is about a cup, a palm is about 3 ounces, so we often talk about a serving size of meat as 3 ounces. So the size of a deck of cards is another example, but that's about the size of your palm without your fingers. The thumb is an ounce, the tip of the thumb is a teaspoon, and a handful is a couple of ounces. So we'll talk about this. This is relevant for things like nuts, for example. All right, we're going to have a whole lecture on sugar from one of the world's experts. So again, I don't want to belabor the point, but just to give you some general statistics, the average person, again, this is, there's probably no one in the room who does this necessarily, but as you take the total per capita intake, it works out that the average person in the United States eats 30 teaspoons of sugar and sweeteners per day, and that adds up to about 15% of your total calories. So a teaspoon is about 4 grams of sugar, so that would be 120 grams and 4 calories per gram, so it would be 480 calories per day as sugars. Too much. The Heart Association, as an example, recommends 24 grams a day for smaller individuals. The gender here difference is based on average sizes. But the recommendations are for substantially less sugar than we eat. And Rob will talk about some of the additional evidence suggesting that simple sugars are toxic in ways over and above the excess calories that they result in. And that I'll leave that to him. But of note, if we look at the 24 grams of sugar a day, medium-sized soda has twice that. And to get to your question a little bit, in some of the things that we think about as sugars, it can be sucrose, but also cane sugar, beet sugar, high fructose corn syrup, dextrose, and honey. All of those have the kind of added sugars that Robert will be talking about that are associated with excess calories and then additional potential metabolic side effects associated with increased risk of heart disease and diabetes. Did you have a question? Yeah. The sugar in fruit is also fructose, but it's packaged differently. You know, I think the thinking is you don't eat the quantities when you eat fruit, and also you're absorbing it more slowly because it's packaged with its fiber, and so it's a different metabolic response to the sugar you eat. If it is true, if you ate a diet which was exclusively fruit sugars, you would have other nutrient deficiencies develop, but you might not have the same calorie to calorie equal risk of, say, high blood insulin, diabetes, insulin resistance, and so on. That's the point that Rob will make, one of the points that he will make, that in this context, a calorie is not a calorie. Sugar in a teaspoon is not the same equal amount as in an apple. But all fruits and vegetables, the calories are all sugars. So that is true, and that's confusing. It's an important question. Thank you. Yes?
Is there a difference between juicing and blending?
Juicing and?
Blending.
Let's hold that question, because I'm not sure exactly what you mean from a food processing point of view, but I'm going to recommend at the end that we don't drink a lot of calories. That's going to be one of my recommendations at the end. The problem with juicing is that you're typically not getting the fiber. If you blend it, if that's what you mean, you would get more of the fiber. But then you are taking in often a very high amount of calories, which is fine. They're healthy, nutrient-dense calories, so that's good. But again, you still have that same budget. And so if you just took in a 400-calorie juice, which was all good, make sure you balance the rest of the day with the rest of what you eat. So you're right. If you juice and eliminate the fiber, that's worse. But So blending will keep you the fiber, but will still give you a larger amount of calories than maybe in some people's caloric requirements. Yeah.
Is molasses the same as corn syrup or honey?
I think so. I actually haven't thought about that in a while. I think the sugar is still fructose. So in that context, it is. So I think many of these sound natural and some of them sound artificial, but biochemically, they're all function when in isolation. Remember, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about adding extra. They all have the same metabolic effect. They're high in calories and they have this extra metabolic effect that Dr. Lustig will talk about. All right, so let's talk about sodium, salt. Now, this is confusing because there are different measurements. So you can talk about milliequivalents of sodium. You can talk about milligrams of sodium, and you can talk about grams of sodium chloride. So when you are reading about sodium, you have to know what unit they're talking about. And I'm not going to give you those numbers tonight, the conversions. So we're going to talk mostly about milligrams of sodium. So if we were converting this into grams of salt, it would be a different number, but they correlate with each other. So don't get confused. Here we're just talking about sodium. Sodium salt has sodium plus chloride, so it weighs more. But it's the sodium element, that molecule that we're concerned about. So the guidelines recommend 2,300 milligrams per day for the general population. Then the recommendations originally also said that for about half the population that we should limit it further to 1,500 milligrams per day, or a gram and a half. So when this recommendation came out, I think it took a while for people to realize, whoa, that's a recommendation that affects half the population. So it's people over 50, African Americans, people with a variety of chronic diseases. So this became a little controversial. And you may have seen just this month, and that may have been the source of your question, that just this month the Institute of Medicine, contradicting the Dietary Guidelines for America recommendations, said, let's slow down on this just a little bit. That the intake in the United States is 3,400 milligrams per day. Let's focus on getting everyone down by a third to about 2,300 a day and stop there. That we don't really fully understand the health consequences of more severe sodium restriction, and therefore we shouldn't recommend it in a widespread way. And there's some evidence for concern if you over-restrict sodium for everyone. But this is, I think, a little bit of a false controversy because very few of us are here. So on average, we're here, which means half of us eat more than that. And that's where the big problems are. And just to put this into food servings, so this is equivalent to a teaspoon of salt. So when you're thinking about cooking with salt, a teaspoon is your daily requirement. So just as a point of reference. So the current recommendations are, let's go down by about a third, it's a decrease of about 3 grams of sodium per day, so of salt per day, if you're into those numbers, and get down to 2,300 milligrams of sodium per day. So that makes it a little easier, and it's an example where sometimes we confuse ourselves with controversial recommendations, and sometimes it's simpler to take one step at a time. And that's what your doctor and you will try to do when you're changing behavior. You go one step at a time, and from a public policy point of view, also one step at a time. One of the things I'll also refer to at the end is sometimes we can't always make the best choice, but we can usually make a better choice. And that's an important concept. This is, I think, an example of that from a policy point of view. Now, some of this controversy came from UCSF, where one of our outstanding scientists did some mathematical modeling which really caught everyone's attention. It was published in the New England Journal, something called the Coronary Heart Disease Policy Model. And basically what they do is they take all of the statistics and on intake and outcomes for the population and basically said, if we decrease salt by a little, by that 3,400 to 2,300, not going down to 1,500, we would prevent a ton of strokes and heart attacks in the United States. And that this was a very large amount equivalent to tobacco. And so it caught a tremendous amount of attention, thinking that this was an intervention that we could make. Now, as I'll show you in a minute, the amount of salt you use at the table or the stove, although potentially a problem, on average is not. And so I'll come back to that. So this suggests, rather, that we need public policy, somewhat more analogous to what we've done with tobacco, in order to address this kind of issue. And England has begun to do this and is beginning to show reductions in stroke. And whether that's cause and effect, I think we don't know. But I think we're beginning to see some enthusiasm for this approach. Yes?
Do we really need salt?
Does the human body need salt? That's a very good question. The answer is not much. There are a group of native South Americans who live in northeastern Brazil, for example, called the Yanomamo Indians, who eat about 5 milligrams of sodium per day and do fine. So you're quite right. A normal kidney is very able to hold on to the body's salt. Now, it depends on your environment and how much you're losing through sweat and other sources, diarrhea and so on. So there are, but the human body in certain circumstances can live without salt, but we cannot design a diet in our society that comes anywhere close to that. So the answer is no, we don't need it. But we can't eat food in our society without some. But it's very hard to get down to 1,500 a day, whereas the 2,300 is a more reasonable goal. And I'll show you how to do that in a minute. Yes?
When you take into account naturally occurring salt, you can easily get to 1,500 without an added, of the teaspoon.
Exactly.
So are we talking about 2,300? Really adding a teaspoon of salt a day with what goes?
No. I was just showing that that's just your total intake. Yeah, no, you're exactly right, and I'll show you the statistics on that in these next two slides. So the point that was being made was that most of the sodium and salt in our diets are not what we make, what we put on food ourselves at the stove or the table. A very small amount is naturally occurring in foods, about 10 or 12%. Home processing, both eating and cooking, is another 10 or 12%. But about 80% comes from processed foods and restaurant foods. So the take-home message here is that anything that's in a bag or a box or a can or in a restaurant, unless it says low salt, is high salt. Now, is the question implied earlier, does it matter for everyone? And the answer is it probably doesn't matter for everyone. But as public policy, it matters on the population. Because if we just shift everyone a little bit, we prevent a lot of strokes and heart attacks. And that's the concept. But for you as an individual, if you don't have high blood pressure and you don't have any other sodium-retaining kind of illnesses and so on, then it may not matter very much whether you eat 2,300 or 3,400. So for people who like salty food, as an individual, if you tend to be heavier at home, that may not be that big an issue, even if you're doing some of this. If you have high blood pressure, though, this might be a tool in your toolbox to lower your blood pressure without medications or with less medications. So low salt with a patient with high blood pressure is effective at lowering the blood pressure both without and with medications. But not in everyone, about a third to a half of patients. Yeah. So the question for everyone, if you didn't hear it, is how malleable are we? How able are we as adults to change all these things that I'm mentioning? And it's a very interesting question because salt, you can change your taste preferences. So if I put you upstairs in the hospital on a metabolic ward and give you some foods and see which ones you prefer, what your salt preferences are, and then I put you on a low-salt diet for 2 to 3 months and bring you back in, you'll now prefer the lower salt tastes. So salt is one that you can relearn in a relatively short period of time. Now, in contrast, calories are a much harder problem. So total calorie intake is harder to break habits, but sodium actually is not that hard. Yes? The question is salt on watermelon. You'll have to ask them. I mean, but some people like salty candy and salty ice cream and salty watermelon, and you know, that it's all personal preference. You know, yes.
What food has sodium that's naturally occurring? What foods have sodium?
I'll show you the list in just a minute. I think it's the next slide. Here are the top sodium sources in the United States, and you can see that some of these are relatively natural occurring foods. So this is where I said remember that first list, because the two are relatively similar, and basically they represent highly processed foods. And so what happens is, as part of the way the food industry has developed, we've added salt and fat and sugar to foodstuffs in such a way that the things that account for most of our calories also account for most of our sodium. So it's the same list of foods. Now, some of them are a little different. Chicken, you know, is different because there's not that much salt in chicken naturally, but they inject chickens with salt water to plump them up. So that's a problem. Another natural one. There aren't too many natural ones on here, but certainly pork would be an example. Some of this is, again, preservative. Cheese, with the E, dairy products have naturally occurring salt. So all foods, most foods have a little. Healthy breads have a little, grains and so forth. But almost all of it, 80% comes from, or 90% is not naturally, not naturally occurring. So again, bread and bread products are very high on this list.
Just a question on chicken. That's not one that's kind of surprised me about these lists being so high. I mean, the high misinformation. Like a grilled chicken breast, which is reasonably good for your relatives. Are you talking about fried chicken?
Yeah. So it's again, this data comes from, remember I showed, when I was talking about nutrient density, I compared, you know, a fried chicken with a grilled chicken breast, and there are very substantial differences in the nutrient density between those two foods. But this comes from food surveys of what people actually eat. So they're checking boxes. So if you ate fried chicken, you would have checked chicken. And if you went to Kentucky Fried Chicken, it doesn't mean that a grilled chicken breast is a problem. Now, it does mean, though, that certain types of chicken have more sodium in them than other types of chicken, depending on whether the processor has injected the chicken with salt water. And that's something sometimes you can tell on the label, although much chicken we buy is not labeled. So that's a little bit of a tricky one. But sort of the more natural food kind of chickens typically will have less of that sort of processing. It's used to plump it up. Let me move on, if you might, and we'll circle back because I want to make sure I get to the end. So again, just to summarize, most of the salt in the diet coming from cereal and cereal products, and others from mostly preserved meat. But dairy products is an example of the naturally occurring foods that are high in sodium. All right, what about the Mediterranean diet? Where does this fit in? What does this refer to? And this comes from the observation, based on population studies, that the cultures that live around the Mediterranean, despite having a higher fat intake, and relatively robust calorie intakes, didn't have a lot of heart disease. And so this was paradoxical, and people began to study their diets and identify different characteristics of the diet, as shown in this pseudo pyramid, food pyramid, with lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. And this is pastas, some of which might be whole wheat. Again, more vegetables. I don't know what all these things are. But the take-home message, lots of olive oil, wine, and some cheese. And then with additional foods, this might have been goat cheese, I can't really tell. More traditional cow cheese up here, some poultry, fish, and then eating red beef, red meats less commonly. So those are many of the elements of the so-called Mediterranean diet. And as my colleague has called it, healthy fats and good carbs with a big side of fruits and vegetables. Now, so we have we had this observational evidence that this particular diet seemed to be healthy and was a little bit different than ours. And so one alternative eating plate was developed. This looks a lot like myplate.gov, but this comes from the Harvard School of Public Health and Walter Willett's group. It's a little bit of a variation on the myplate.gov with a little bit more of an emphasis on what would be trended towards a Mediterranean-style diet. So now, in addition, he's making a stronger statement about the quality of the food. So now it's healthy protein, not just protein, emphasizing fish, poultry, beans, and nuts, limit red meat, avoid bacon, cold cuts, and other processed meats. Whole grains, again, similar to what we've discussed. No caloric beverages, so little or no sugar drinks, and a little bit of dairy if that's your only source of calcium, but low fat. And then adding healthy oils. And that's one of the big differences between our diet, typically where much of the fat initially was saturated fat from from butter, and then trans fats in margarines. And he'll make other potatoes and french fries don't count under vegetables, and eat plenty of fruits of colors. And here was the big news this spring. It was this winter, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which was, again, now a different kind of study. So almost everything we know up to this point, more or less, comes from these association studies that we talked about, the kind of research where you take a population and say, well, this group of vegetarians compared to this group of meat eaters, the vegetarians have less heart disease. And so the vegetarian diet is associated with less heart disease. But is it cause and effect? And the way we learn cause and effect scientifically is what we call a randomized experiment or a randomized controlled clinical trial. And this was a very interesting one. It was done in Spain. And they took 7,000 men and women. Most of them were pretty high risk. They had diabetes and other cardiovascular risk factors. They were followed for 5 years. And the design was interesting. They were from Spain, so they all ate a typical Spanish diet, and they had a specific scale of different foods that they could rank how Mediterranean it was, if you will. And generally, in all three groups, fell into the range they would consider consistent with a Mediterranean diet, even though the Spanish diet is evolving a little bit, becoming more like ours, certainly in some cities. But the design was, so they all started with roughly the same, quote, Mediterranean diet. And then they took one group and they said, I'm going to change your diet and make it more low fat. So more the way we used to teach good nutrition. So taking out the oil, taking out some of the cheese, taking out the beef, and so on. So they became the comparison group. Unfortunately, they didn't change their diet very much. So they were still on a pretty similar Mediterranean diet when all was said and done. But it was a little bit different. But the other two groups, one, they gave a whole bunch of olive oil, and they gave it to them for free, and it was extra virgin. And the olive oil was provided by a company, so there is some potential here for bias. But the study seems to be clean of bias, but it's always worth noting the source. And secondly, the second group, they gave an ounce of nuts. And these were almonds, hazelnuts, and walnuts, I believe. So they're mostly tree nuts. And then they followed them for 4.5 years or so, and it turned out, I don't have the absolute numbers here, but it turned out the people in the olive oil group and the nut group had less heart attacks, less strokes, and less overall mortality. So this is one of the first big studies that really tries to answer a nutritional question using our highest level of scientific design. So very provocative. It wasn't a perfect study because it doesn't really come away proving that a Mediterranean diet is better, but it does suggest that a diet that includes more olive oil as compared to less and or more nuts, especially tree nuts, is better. So this is, again, the first study. We often in medicine try not to make major decisions based upon only one study, but it's a very good study. It's not as generalizable as some people have read into it, but it does suggest that there are health benefits that really are health benefits, not just an association, but less stroke and heart attacks from diets that include nuts and olive oil. Yes?
How about the omega-6s that they say is negative and it's found a lot in nuts?
What?
Omega-6.
In what context?
Being negative.
But there's also a lot of omega-3s. So I think that's a more complex issue. And again, this is not a study that answers the question of omega-3s versus omega-6. This is a study that simply says a handful of nuts versus not, what happens. And so we can now then try to interpret why it might have happened. But all this is saying is that if people added nuts to their diet, they had less strokes and heart attacks. So that's pretty powerful. So it doesn't explain why. So I think we can begin to recommend, and the dietary guidelines suggest this anyway, that adding a small amount of nuts to the diet per day is healthy. So it's in about an ounce of nuts. Remember, that was a small palmful, a quarter of a cup if you prefer. But remember that these are high in calories. And so again, think of your budget. And again, if you're adding nuts, then you have less room for something else.
What is the value of most nuts and the store with salt in them?
Right. Well, again, I think it depends. The way to think of those kind of questions is to think about each element of the food as a separate decision for yourself. In other words, if you're trying to reduce your salt intake, then that wouldn't be a good food choice. But if you're trying to increase your nut intake, it would be. So then you have to balance those, but the easy solution is you go find yourself some nuts without salt, which are totally findable. Totally findable. So we would recommend against eating highly salted nuts, since that would contribute to too high a sodium intake. But again, it depends on your sodium budget, right? So if you're now, instead of a 2,000 calorie budget, you have a 2,300 milligram sodium budget, and the question is how are you going to fill it? If you fill it with nuts, then you have less room for other foods. So those are choices you have to make, yes. Most cold cuts, as commonly sold in the United States, are highly processed and have a fair amount of added salt to it. So it wouldn't be the first choice. On the other hand, again, if you're thinking about each nutrient as its own problem to solve, if you're looking for total calories as a primary concern or fat intake, then a lean cold cut might be fine. But if sodium is a problem for you, or you're trying to avoid other preservatives, say, or nitrates or whatever, then it wouldn't be a good choice for you. Thank you. All right, what about vegetarian diets? Two take-home messages about vegetarian diets. One is, if someone tells you they're a vegetarian, you don't have a clue about what they're really eating, right? So people who are vegetarian or who eat a wide variety of amounts of dairy and meat, fish, and fowl often all commonly call themselves vegetarians. And again, you don't know what that means. More importantly, even if you knew what it meant in terms of meat, fish, and fowl, and dairy, you still don't know about the quality of the other food that they're eating. So in other words, you can eat a perfectly healthy vegetarian diet. You can eat a perfectly healthy diet with meat, fish, and fowl. You can eat a perfectly unhealthy vegetarian diet, and you can eat a perfectly unhealthy diet with meat, fish, and fowl in any combination. So if your preference is to be a vegetarian, then that will make it easier to accomplish certain nutritional goals because the food is more calorie dense, that it's typically lower in calories, more nutrients, less fat, less refined carbohydrates. And there may be a variety of advantages to eating a vegetarian diet. But when you think about it nutritionally and not just based upon the label. And this is just some examples. So vegans don't eat any animal products. You can have different amounts of milk and egg and different amounts of fish and chicken. And then there's also a pollo pesky vegetarian who eat fish and chicken but not red meat or pork. And then there are people who call themselves often I think the fashionable word is flexitarians, although the nutritional term is closer to semi-vegetarian or partial vegetarian, and that's people who do eat meat, fish, and fowl, including beef, but not that often. And so there are a variety of ways to mix and match with meat, fish, and fowl, but the key point is that it only tells you about one element of the diet and not about all the things that we were talking about in terms of quantity. It doesn't tell you anything about that or the quality of the foods. It does tell you a little bit about the variety, or in this case, the restriction of variety. But the real take-home point is that there is no clinical circumstance that I can think of that is growth, reproduction, or any illness in which a vegetarian diet cannot be designed to meet your nutritional needs. In other words, we can do everything with a vegetarian diet that you could possibly imagine nutritionally. So if you want to be a vegetarian, and many people choose to do so not for nutritional reasons at all, but may do so for ethical reasons or religious reasons or ecological reasons, certainly a growing literature about the amount of energy it takes generate beef products, for example, that many people will choose to eat vegetarian diets for totally non-nutritional reasons, and that's totally legitimate.
Is there a difference between organic and non-organic?
Well, that's a tougher question, and I'm going to pause on that one tonight, maybe not get into that too much tonight. There are some differences related to insecticide levels and, in some cases, nutrient density, but there's a wide variance of overlap, and it's a all right, let me end, move a little quicker so we can end and open it up again. Say a few words about physical activity, and again, I'll come back to this again next week. Here are the current recommendations. Again, there are several different guidelines out there, but it's a lot, right? So the take-home message here is that no matter how big you are, if you're overweight or normal weight, that you want to be as fit as you can possibly be at that weight. So independent of weight loss, you want to get fit. And we'll talk about that next week as well. Another rule of thumb is don't go to sleep tonight without knowing how, in your busy day tomorrow, you're going to figure out how to exercise. Right? It says daily. That's my own personal recommendation. But a more common recommendation is to be biblical. So 6 days a week, one day of rest. But if you can do seven and without hurting yourself by mixing up your exercises, that's fine. Remember that fitness includes cardiovascular fitness, strength, flexibility, and balance. So there are all four components. So as you're thinking about your fitness, don't just focus on one out of proportion to the others. The dose is very high. So 60 minutes or more physical activity a day. This says for children and adolescents, but it's also the recommendation, as I'll show you next week, for of the dose to prevent weight gain. We're talking about the, but many of the guidelines say 30 minutes of moderate activity minimum for adults 6 days a week. And again, strength training, flexibility, and balance training as well. And again, something is better than nothing, but the goal is high. All right. Michael Pollan's three rules, you know, after all we've discussed, it turns out that he nailed it. It's very hard to do better than these simple rules. You know these. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Now, here are my rules that just drill down on these a little bit more and added a few additional dimensions. His are better, but mine have more information. But his are better. The same as eat food, I would just say eat unprocessed food whenever you can. That's what he means. So we totally agree on that one. Eat the right amount of food to maintain your body weight. That's what he means by not too much. We're totally on the same page. And eat something colorful at every meal. And if you're going to snack, have that be colorful too. And I don't mean Skittles. And again, that's also what he's saying by saying eat mostly plants. All right, now a few other rules. And again, I'm confident he would agree with these as well. This is a little bit confusing, but as a general rule, don't drink calories. Now, there are some exceptions to that. So if you're an alcohol user or a wine drinker, then that's fine. Again, just add up the calories as part of that budget. And there are some health benefits of moderate alcohol use for those who use alcohol. It's part of the Mediterranean diet concept. So totally healthy. The dose, I think, we're still debating. But just keep in mind that it's caloric. Low-fat milk is another issue in, when I say this, because for some people, that's still your best source of calcium. And so, but many adults can't drink milk or don't drink milk. But a little bit of low-fat milk as a calcium source throughout the day, again, accounting for it in your calories is fine. In fact, it's recommended. But as a general rule in our society, where so many of the extra calories come from soda pop and fruit juices, a good rule of thumb is don't drink calories unless you have a specific purpose in mind for doing so. This is a comment I made before. If you can't make the best choice, make a better choice. So don't let perfection stand in the way of the very good. So when you're choosing foods, if you can't get exactly, you can be at a fast food restaurant but still make a good food choice. As we talked about, be as fit as you can be. Exercise biblically. And then if you still have children around, eat with your children. Probably the most important thing we can do as parents. So I think with that, I'll stop. I've included on the handout a variety of really excellent websites. I'll stay and answer your questions. And thank you very much for your attention. Yes. Is turkey a better choice than chicken? Again, it depends. It depends how it's prepared and how it's processed. And in equal preparation methods, no, they would be equivalent. Yes. So the question is, if sugar and salt is bad, are there foods you can eat that offset that badness? Is that? Again, everything in moderation. You know, so this is not cut and dry. So I don't want you to go away and think that all sugars are bad. We gave some examples before of all the calories in fruits and vegetables are simple sugars. And there are simple sugars in dairy products as well. So it's not a matter that a simple sugar is bad. What's bad is the indiscriminate addition of simple sugars to foods that markedly increase their calorie worth and provide a large amount of simple sugars that are quickly absorbed. So you can't offset it, but you can moderate it and put it in the context of your budget. Yes, I can't see you all very well, so yell out.
About all the media and the rates around lowering foods that are inflammatory, specifically like gluten?
Yeah, I think we're going to talk about gluten a little bit later in the course. It's a very important and controversial area. There is a disease for which people have gluten allergies, a gluten allergy, and they develop a disease called SPRU, which is a very serious illness that must be treated with a gluten-free diet. There's another realm of hypothesis that for that other people react to gluten in a way that's more subtle and not as well defined, that may also be disadvantageous to them, and that they feel better on a gluten-free diet. I have several patients who have articulated that, and I say to them, stay on a gluten-free diet. Gluten-free diet can be a totally healthy diet, but the scientific evidence is not has not yet established the full role of a gluten-free diet in patients with that kind of gluten intolerance. So that's an open question. But if you feel better on a gluten-free diet, you can certainly, there are many advantages. A gluten-free diet, remember, gluten is the food mostly in wheat products and several other grains. And we spent a lot of time bad-mouthing refined wheat here. So a gluten-free diet gets you to some goodness through a strategy that's not proven, but it does get you to a point where it might be a healthier diet. So I don't advocate a gluten-free diet except for people with celiac SPRU. But again, if that's the tactic you use to get to a healthier diet along the lines of what we discussed, then that might work for you. And like I said, I have several patients who say they feel much, much better on their gluten-free diet. And I say, congratulations, that's great. Yes. The question is, why would an adult drink milk other than the calcium? There's not really that many reasons. Again, you want to think of each nutrient as its own problem to solve. So it's a good protein source. It tastes good. There's vitamin D fortified and calcium. So, you know, there are several reasons why you might. But in general, a very high percentage of adults in the United States cannot digest lactose as adults. So that eliminates a lot of people right away. And then for those typically of Northern European ancestry who can digest lactose better, although it's not black, it's not cut and dry, then it's a perfectly good food source. But it's, again, you're drinking calories, so you don't get as much of the satiety, of the fullness. But it would be fine. It's just, again, in moderation as part of your budget for calcium, your budget for calories, your budget for protein, and so on. Yes? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Will these slides be online?
Yes, absolutely.
Are you going to talk about artificial sweeteners?
I will. I wasn't going to, but that's a great suggestion. I'll do that next week. There was a new study on that just came out this year that, in case you miss it, that did suggest that people who drank diet sodas did worse than just as bad as people who drank regular sodas as far as heart disease. So we're not a big advocate of artificial sweeteners. And that evidence is still evolving, but this new study, I'll put it in next week. Yes, good. So the question is, what about coffee? Coffee is the Teflon nutrient. And what I mean by that is people have tried to pin every known disease on coffee and caffeine, and nothing has stuck. So there is no evidence that coffee is bad for your health on average, at least in terms of heart disease, stroke, cancers, and so on. Now, some people get peptic ulcer disease from caffeine. It does stimulate acid secretion. And some people get hyper, you know, behaviorally, or anxiety, or sleep disorders, urinary issues, incontinence. So there are a variety of irritable bowel syndrome or gas. So there are a variety of conditions that can bother patients or that can be coffee related. But as far as if you don't have any of those side effects and you just like your coffee, there's no evidence that it's bad for your health in terms of the things we've been talking about in terms of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and cancer. Yes, in the back. And I should say, I didn't show a disclosure slide, but I should have at the beginning. But I have no financial conflict of interest or any other kind of financial interest with any of the products or services I've been discussing tonight, including coffee. Yeah, that's a really good question. And the answer, so the question is, do you have to get your vitamins every day? Or the easy answer is that some are soluble in water. You know, you can put them in and they dissolve, and some are insoluble in water. And the ones that are insoluble in water are fat soluble, and they are stored in the body. So those clearly you do not need to take daily. So if someone's vitamin D deficient, for example, we might give them an injection once a month or once a week. So that's an example of a storage. Vitamin B12 is another example. Even though that's water soluble, it's stored in the liver. So you can achieve normalcy and sustain that for a long period of time. The other water soluble vitamins have a half-life or a lifespan in the blood that can be quite short. And we don't know whether it's a day or 2 days or a week, but it's short. So the water-soluble vitamins do need to be eaten on a relatively regular basis, we think, although, remember, we discovered them because of deficiency syndromes that developed over long periods of time. So if you skip a week of niacin, you don't develop pellagra, right? And it takes a period of time for that to happen. So we think biochemically you're using it every day and there's not much stored. So we think it needs to be relatively frequent. But we don't know the precise answer to that. But fat-soluble vitamins clearly do not need to be daily. Yes? Right. So the question is, does it matter whether you eat small amounts throughout the day or several or one larger feeding? In the animal nutrition literature and somewhat in the human nutrition literature, that's called binging versus grazing. And in general, we think that there are a couple of lines of evidence, a couple of situations in which grazing is preferable. So for example, if you need 2,000 calories a day to maintain your body weight, and I put you on a 1,500 calorie a day diet and expect you to lose a pound a week, and I'll explain that next week. If you eat that all as one meal compared to eating that throughout the day in a grazing fashion, you'll lose more weight with the grazing than you would with the one meal a day. And the reason for that is something called the thermogenic effect of food. That is, every time you eat, you rev up your metabolism and you use calories to eat, digest, metabolize. And so each time you sort of turn on the system, if you will, you're burning more calories, so that's the advantage. There are a couple of other settings in which grazing may also be advantageous, and I'll show you some data on that next week. But in general, I think it's a subtle point and not an important one. If you prefer to eat three meals a day versus someone else who prefers to eat six meals a day or six feedings a day, the key question is what's the nutrient quality, what's the variety, and what's the quantity, same as we would for in general. And if they're the same, then the differences don't matter very much. Yes? So the question is about preservatives and other food additives. You know, that's controversial because the way we as a society approve those is what we call generally recognized as safe. And so if they're in the food supply, they've been generally recognized as safe and in a formal kind of way, and it allows the food industry to add those chemicals to the food. Most of them, I think, have turned out not to be that toxic as an individual chemical. If we identify one as toxic, the mechanisms for getting it off the market aren't bad, although there may be subtleties that we don't understand. What's more of a problem, though, is you can't make a lot of these bad foods unless you use those chemicals, right? So it's not so much that those additives are bad, although there may be some exceptions. Some people may react to MSG or there may be other examples. But so it's not so much the chemicals on the average, though, as much as the foods it allows you to create that don't abide by the nutritional principles we've discussed. So yes, you would be better off eating a diet without those chemicals, but more because that would force you to eat things that are less processed and more fresh fruits and vegetables. Yes? So the question is eating foods separately. That's been a hypothesis for some time, and it's not evidence-based. So that has not been scientifically proven, and there's not a stitch of evidence that you can't eat foods together. In fact, that's how we evolved. That's how people in eating natural diets eat their foods, and there's no reason to worry about that. So you can eat your fruit with your sandwich or with your salad or whatever. Yes?
Along those lines, I'm kind of curious. If you eat a big scoop of ice cream a day, it fits into the 2,000 calories. Is it better to eat it with a really solid, good, integrated meal that's diverse? Or if you eat it midday?
No. No, it's equally good, bad, or indifferent. So what you eat it with, no. You don't get extra credit if you eat something that you think you shouldn't eat just because you ate it with something you thought you should eat. But again, the point of this talk isn't to say you shouldn't have ice cream. You know, the thought of this talk is to think about your nutrient requirements and fit it in to a package, to a budget.
I was thinking along the lines of visualizing. I, by the way, had gained 20 pounds in the last year. I had to gain 20 pounds, so because I'd lost a lot of weight. And so I ate ice cream regularly, and I worried about, like, clogging my heart all the time. And so I'd, like, eat it with a really well-balanced meal, salads and everything, but I just wondered.
You didn't have to do it that way, although it was, if it motivated you to eat lots of other healthy foods as a way to fill your budget, that was good. But no, you don't get any extra credit for that. Yeah, maybe just a few more. Yes, that's a great question. How can the food industry be motivated to improve their processes? Well, I think that's a very political question that we could have an interesting conversation about. You know, certainly the choices that we as consumers make have a big impact on industry. But there are also, you know, very complex incentives provided via the governmental programs and other factors. The Farm Bill, you know, heavily subsidizes corn production, which leads to a lot of high fructose corn syrup and so forth. So it depends a little bit on your political perspective and what you think about big companies and how to change big companies. But there's a lot of impetus favoring their current approach to the development and marketing of food, and the amount of money that's spent on advertising around good nutrition is very trivial compared to the amount of money that's spent on marketing what may be unhealthy food. So I don't know, that's one we'll have to think about and think about as a group.
Will food increase food quality?
Yes, we asked, someone else asked that as well. Does organic food increase food quality? I think that's a little controversial. I think, you know, I think the answer is probably yes. But there have been some studies that show the nutrient density isn't that different between organic and inorganic. But organic may have other advantages. There are less insecticides. That may be environmentally preferable. It may be more local in terms of energy costs, in terms of transportation, and so on. But in terms of the actual nutrient density of the orange, say, or the tomato, it may not be a very significant difference. But there may still be other advantages, more environmental possibly than nutritional, that would urge us to eat that way. Insecticides are one issue that I think we don't really understand the full health implications of, but they can't be great for us. You know, so I think avoiding foods with a lot of insecticides, and that's why you wash foods in part, but also a lot of the insecticides are under the skin, and so that means you'd have to peel the foods. And then you're losing a lot of the dietary fiber. So in that sense, organic has certain advantages.
Well, there's a UC Berkeley article on the internet that you can find. It says that organic uses pesticides too. It's just that they use organic pesticides. And synthetic pesticides, half of them are carcinogenic. And according to this article, half of the organic pesticides are carcinogenic.
Right.
So there may not be any.
Yeah, so I don't know if everyone heard the comment, but it does reflect the uncertainty related to the toxicity of certain chemicals, both natural and synthetic, as far as toxicity. Maybe one last question. Yes?
Are there any differences between the nutrient value between normal foods and any of the new, the, I guess, more sensitive GMO foods?
I think we don't know the answer to that. I think, again, it's a little bit analogous. It's different, but it's somewhat analogous to the organic versus non-organic discussion. It's a little bit different, but by analogy. Again, I think at the end of the day, the nutrient characteristics of the food seem very similar, but there may be other reasons not to favor one type or the other. So I think we're still in the early stage of understanding those differences. All right, we should stop. I'll stay around for a few more minutes.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.